welcome to the Martian Drive-In podcast number 66. My name is Terry Frost, and this time around, we're doing some fun science fiction movies for a bit of a change. Well, Ant-Man was fun last time, but we're doing it anyway. First movie I'm going to do is from 1988, and to commemorate the life and career of Roddy Piper, I'm looking at Hell Comes to Frogtown, also starring Sandor Bergman and William Smith. Then we zip pan onwards slightly to 1998 for Space Truckers, starring Dennis Hopper, Stephen Dorff, and Debbie Mazar. So they're both going to be a bit lighter this time, a bit of fun, pre-CG science fiction movies, but a lot of fun in spite of that. So sit back, I'll get the contact details out of the way, and then we'll get on with the show. The Martian Drive-In podcast appears every 2 weeks and is a podcast of science fiction, horror, and fantasy movie appreciation. It doesn't matter what it is. It could be all the way from Georges Méliès through to Michael Bay, though I'm not likely to do Michael Bay. But feedback is important to me. So if you want to leave some feedback, you can leave it at cultguru, K-U-L-T-G-U-R-U, at gmail.com. You can leave it at the Martian Drive-In podcast website, marsdrivein.blogspot.com. The other thing you can do is go over to the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook. So if you type in Paleo-Cinema Cafe into Facebook, you can go and leave some feedback there as well. Now, there are occasionally adult concepts in this podcast, so just keep that in mind as you listen, and sit back and enjoy the rest of the show. Hey, how's it going? I had a couple of weeks off work because I've been looking after Sal. She's been a bit ill, but it gave me a chance to see a lot of movies and to kind of do some other stuff as well as nursemaiding the missus. I forgot to mention last time around New Horizons, the Pluto flyby that occurred 2 weeks ago, which was incredibly cool. Just looked it up on Wikipedia. They've been planning this thing for 25 years and finally got there after 25 years and whipped past Pluto. It's the fastest object we ever launched from Earth, 16-odd kilometres per second. It was travelling when it escaped Earth's gravity field and, of course, the solar gravity as well. So, very cool thing. They're going crazy naming things on Pluto now. They've named some stuff after Cthulhu. They've got some Star Trek stuff in there. They've got some Star Wars stuff up there. They've got all sorts of stuff. So, scientists are just going bug-fuck naming things the way you can when you discover something new and spend 25 years of your life doing it. It's very cool. They found out that there are glaciers of solid nitrogen, which is, take a breath. Most of what you breathe in there is nitrogen. So this stuff's a solid at the temperatures on Pluto, and it has glaciers of the stuff flowing down off mountains. So that's incredibly cool. We didn't know that could happen, but it can, and it just goes to show that science is wonderful. We've got to keep exploring stuff. There are groovy things happening out there, and the fact that we can, given the lag for light speed, look at this stuff in real time is pretty fucking spectacular, if you ask me. And all credit to NASA and everybody who worked on it, all credit to people around the world who worked on it, including the relay stations that take the signal when America is turned facing the other way from Pluto. So, yeah, that was pretty fucking wonderful and pretty cool. Less cool, of course, was the death of Roddy Piper. Most people know him as an actor. Some people knew him as a wrestler, but I didn't. It wasn't kind of on my radar, wrestling, because I don't want to see guys grappling with each other. I want to see women grappling with each other, because that's the way I'm oriented. Nonetheless, he had an interesting and kind of quirky career as an actor. They Live, of course, being the high point there, the John Carpenter movie, which is very, very cool, and I may do later in the podcast at a future time. But this time I wanted to kind of do something lighter. I knew I was going to be doing Space Truckers when Roddy stepped on the rainbow, and so I wanted to get something kind of equally matched with Space Truckers, and the go-to Roddy Piper movie for that, of course, was Hell Comes to Frogtown, which is kind of cool, politically incorrect, as only a movie from the 1980s can be, but nonetheless it does kind of turn over some gender stereotypes in an interesting way. So it is time for What Have I Been Watching? Okay, Mission Impossible Rogue Nation came out, and I've got a kind of weird relationship with the Mission Impossible films. I like them, but I don't like Tom Cruise. Now, yes, that is contradictory and contrary, but I picked up the movies on a four-disc box set of the first four movies for something ridiculously cheap on Blu-ray, and so I binge-watched the first four Mission Impossible films so that I could watch Rogue Nation. And yes, it is really cool. Yes, Tom Cruise does run. Yes, it's interesting that they got a whole bunch of actors to star with him, with the exception of Ving Rhames, who aren't particularly taller than him. But yeah, it works really well as an action flick. It's got some really nice tentpole stunt bits. It's got a really nice female protagonist in it, played by Rebecca Ferguson. She should get a spin-off series of her own, as many people have said online. Her character, Ilse Faust, is a great action character in her own right, without standing in the shadow of Tom Cruise's character. And, yeah, she should get her own movie series. And, of course, Faust, being her last name, gives you a bit of an idea about her relationship with various intelligence organizations in the movie. It does work well. The ensemble works well. Simon Pegg's there, of course. Jeremy Renner's there again. Ving Rhames is there. So it kind of works. Alec Baldwin's there playing a kind of stick-up-the-ass bureaucrat. There's a few other people in there. Simon McBurney's very good in it. And the main villain, which is kind of underplayed for some odd choice by Sean Harris. Character's name is Solomon Lane. He kind of does underplay it and does come across it slightly spooky, but it doesn't have that larger-than-life villainy that you kind of want in this kind of a spy movie. Nonetheless, the movie works well, and I enjoyed seeing it in the cinema. The cinema wasn't particularly packed at the time, but Sal was off having some medical stuff done. I had about a 3-hour window there, so I went and saw the movie. So that's part of what I've been watching. Let's see what else we've got here. So I did have a Shane Black thing where I wanted to see a Shane Black movie that I hadn't seen for a while. And I was wandering through a department store and saw they had The Long Kiss Goodnight for $5 on DVD. I was trying to find a torrent of it anyway, but I thought $5, I'm going to actually do the right and legal thing and do it. So I did. I bought The Long Kiss Goodnight and watched it. Gina Davis, Samuel L. Jackson. Works really well. I'm not sure Craig Bierko is kind of strong enough an actor in that kind of gravitas kind of way to be the main villain effectively. But nonetheless, that works. It's got all of the over-the-top Christmas action film stuff that is a kind of almost a trademark of Shane Black's work. And it works really well. I'm not too sure how Samuel L. Jackson was supposed to get up and dust himself off after an explosion threw him through the sign, the big neon advertising sign for a hotel, and into a bunch of trees. But, you know, you kind of roll with that kind of an action film. And one of the things it does well is it's entertainment. It's pure entertainment. And in that, it does the job really nicely. And Gina Davis and Samuel L. Jackson play off each other kind of well as well. It's got Brian Cox in it, which is always fun. Brian Cox has a very crucial role in one torture scene where he doesn't have to do too much acting at all. But nonetheless, I did enjoy revisiting The Long Kiss Goodnight, and it's now on my shelves because I didn't have a copy of it for some reason. As you may know from listening before, I do have a fondness for the DC animated films that come out. And I just saw one called Justice League Gods and Monsters, which is a kind of alternate universe Justice League, which works really well. The story's good, the voice acting's good, the animation really works well, and it takes things in a different direction and explores different aspects of what if, particularly when it comes to Superman's life and Superman's backstory. Now, I'm not going to do a spoiler on that, but it does have the chops to be really interesting, and it does kind of take those risks and take it to places that are quite dark. And I did enjoy it. I'd heard good things about it. There have been a few rumors around that the movie was really cool, and to be honest with you, yeah, it was. If you get a chance to see Justice League Gods and Monsters, you're not going to be wasting your time to do so. I did fill a gap in my knowledge of the works of Alfred Hitchcock, and it's a gap that shouldn't have been there. But for the first time, I saw Notorious. the Alfred Hitchcock movie starring Ingrid Bergman and Cary Grant. It's from 1946, and the reason I saw it is kind of a backwards reason. But Mission Impossible 2, the one that's set pretty much in my hometown of Sydney, is a spy movie remake of Notorious. The screenwriter Robert Towne has admitted as much, and I can see so many parallels between the two. One on a much larger and much brighter scale than the other, of course. But nonetheless, it really was a remake of Notorious, and seeing the original was really good. The ensemble in that's good too. You've got Claude Rains playing the third wheel. You've got that great rapport and chemistry between Cary Grant and Ingrid Bergman, who was basically having an affair with an artist at the time, so there wasn't any kind of romantic stuff there. And of course, there's always that argument about whether Cary Grant was straight or not. I'm not going to enter into that. Ain't my business. But, yeah, I'm going to rewatch Notorious sometime in the next 12 months because I really want to visit that again and kind of cement in that gap in my knowledge of Hitchcockian films. The nice thing is Hitchcock's cameo doesn't come until about an hour in, so it goes to some very dark places, and it's probably one of the first movies, apart from maybe The Secret Agent, which goes into what's necessary in espionage to achieve your goals and the price that some people have to pay to do so, and it does it within the within the context of a romantic thriller, which is really interesting. And I do like the fact that for 1946 they went there and they did what they did, and that Hitchcock did somehow wiggle his way through censorship to get the story told in the particular way that it was. So Notorious, I'm going to have to do it on a Paleo Cinema podcast, I've decided, because I really want to kind of unwrap that a bit more and go into the way that it does what it does. It's going to be a spoiler-filled Paleo Cinema when I do it, but it's in the book and it's on the list. And I enjoyed the fuck out of it too, which is never a bad thing. The other thing I did was I revisited a movie I was going to do for Martian Drive-In, but then the Hell Comes to Frogtown thing came up, and that's The Relic, the 1998 movie starring Tom Sizemore and Penelope Ann Miller and Linda Hunt and a few other people about a monster loose in a museum in Chicago, which is a lot of fun. It's got some very nice Stan Winston effects in it. It's got some nice character actor bits in it as well, and it's a good, honest, unashamed, unabashed action film and monster movie as well, which I really do like. I enjoy the way that this one was done. It was directed by Peter Hyams, who's never been one of the top directors, but is kind of good at this kind of genre work. And yeah, I did have a bit of fun watching that too. I've actually watched a few enjoyable movies this time around, which is kind of cool. Let's see, how many movies have I done this year so far? How many movies have I watched this year? I think it's around 238 or something along those lines. Not as many as last year, but I'd be kidding you if I said I was going for quality over quantity. It's just that I've been doing some other things. It was just real life stuff, which is a bit random, but nonetheless, I have been doing that. Anyway, I'm going to take a break now. When I get back, we're going to talk about the first two of the films. The one, Roddy Piper's first feature film as a star, to the extent that he was ever a star, and that is the 1988 film Hell Comes to Frogtown.
In the future, after the big war, there will come a time to rebuild and a need for a new and special kind of soldier.
This man is carrying a loaded weapon.
Prepare to meet the next great American hero.
That's where you come in.
Are you serious?
His name is
Hell. Sam Hell.
Never heard of you.
We're going to Frogtown.
And this is the adventure he's been waiting for.
We're going to get him out, and then you're going to get him pregnant.
And if anyone's got a chance in hell of rescuing the virgins from the evil clutches of Toady,
it's a miracle.
Right. Let's go.
And escaping from Frogtown, it's Sam.
Shit. Holy shit!
Be there for the action. the adventure.
Oh, Sam,
what are you doing?
And be there for the dance of the three snakes.
Dance or die.
We're all gonna die.
When hell comes to Frogtown. Starring Rowdy Roddy Piper as Sam.
Turn off!
You are one weird dude.
Sandel Bergman as Nurse Spangle.
Wired to blow.
Hell comes to Frogtown.
Eat that, froggies!
Hell Comes Frogtown is a 1988 movie made by New World Pictures. It was directed by Donald G. Jackson, who worked with Horman for a while, as indeed did a lot of other people. And of course, we know who it stars: Rowdy Roddy Piper, also known as Roddy Piper, depends on whether he's wrestling or not. Does have an interesting cast apart from him too: Sandel Bergman, Sess Ferrell, who's a very attractive woman playing Sentinella, William Smith, who we know from Darker Than Amber, which I spoke about on the last Paleo Cinema podcast, and a bunch of other things. Rory Calhoun, who was an old cowboy actor from the 1950s, whose career tanked for a number of reasons. A, he couldn't act very well. B, he had a juvie crime thing, which Confidential magazine revealed, and that kind of knocked his career around. And C, he got in a lot of trouble because pretty much he'd fuck any woman that moved. He got into a lot of trouble with his illicit affairs in the 1950s. And so he ended up doing peplum epics in Italy in the 60s. And his career kind of tanked. Nonetheless, he's a striking looking guy. He's playing an older guy in this one called Looney Tunes. But I probably should tell you about Roddy Piper's character first. He plays Sam Hell. It's a post-apocalyptic situation, of course, as the trailer indicates. And human fertility has tanked. In the meantime, for some reason known only to people who make these kind of movies, frogs have become intelligent. So there's a whole place called Frogtown. They're an oppressed minority of freaks, in a sense. There's a borderland where the humans resist invasion by the frogs, in a sense, out in the desert there. And there's a special med tech corps, whose job it is basically to repopulate the human race. Medtech is very much a female-only organization. There aren't any men in Medtech. And they suddenly find that this kind of renegade male, Sam Hell, played by Roddy Piper, is very, very... his sperm works very, very well. And so they recruit him and sign him up to impregnate women for them, which you would think is an okay job, and he was doing a pretty good job freelancing that. In fact, he's in trouble at the start of the movie for knocking up William Smith's character's daughter. The William Smith character is called Captain Devlin, and he pretty much is on the verge of being killed for knocking up this military guy's daughter, even though in the culture that they posit in the post-apocalyptic time, women who are pregnant and who are mothers are pretty much treated very well in the society. They're important to the future of the human race. Therefore, their social cachet is high. Now, that's a kind of optimistic viewpoint of it. If it was a real-world situation, things would be very darker and much less cool than that situation. But this is the way it's posited in the movie. Now, New World Pictures at the time was going through an interesting transition. In 1987, Roger Corman sold it to a large company, which then decided it was going to swallow up other companies, as indeed was common in the 1980s and up until now. At the time, they owned Marvel Comics, which is a shame because they could have used that in their movie stuff had they chosen to start the Marvel Cinematic Universe about 25, 30 years earlier. But they chose not to do that. They did a couple of things, like the shitty Captain America movie and some Spider-Man stuff, but nothing much with the intellectual property that they had from that. But I found it interesting that New World at the time owned Marvel. They did try to get Mattel and Hasbro as well. They tried to buy out Mattel and Hasbro so they get the toy franchises and things like that. But, interesting corporate time in the movie industry, particularly with those lesser players. There were so many different bits of moving around and changes of ownership at the time that it was a little hard to keep up. But you can research it on Wikipedia, and if you're into that kind of stuff, you can kind of trace through, you know, this company owned that company, that was bought out by that company, and all that kind of shit. But nonetheless, they were making money not as well as they would have liked to. And so budgets weren't high, production values weren't fantastic, and they wanted to make cheap stuff which would play well on VHS. You could put it out in a few theatres, but it would go really well on VHS and kind of play to that market in that sense, and play to the cable TV market. And Hell Comes to Frogtown is pretty much in line with that. Like I said before, politically correct is all shit, but nonetheless, a bit of an entertainment and very much of its time, and that's not necessarily a bad thing. But to get back to the movie, Sam Hell is recruited, and they put him in a kind of chastity belt, which has a few interesting functions. If he gets too far away from his handler, Spangle, who's played by Sandor Bergman, he gets an electric shock to his nuts, or to his dick even. And if he gets really far away from her, there's an explosive part to the chastity belt which will blow up his groin. Not the sort of thing you want to have, and it's not something I'd particularly sign up for if it was me. Nonetheless, he's taken along because they've got to go and grab a whole bunch of fertile virgins that have been captured by the frogs and kept in Frogtown. Their job is to head in there, Sam Hell, Spangle, and their gun person, Sentinella, played by Seth Ferrell, end up going into the Badlands, where the frogs are, in a Studebaker van with a sunroof and a machine gun mounted on the top of it to rescue these women. Now, Sandor Bergman, really interesting person in a lot of ways. She was one of Bob Fosse's dancers. If you've seen the erotica scene in All That Jazz, she's the blonde center dancer in that, and she moves beautifully. Unfortunately, she's not gifted as an actor, whether the dance training precluded that, or whether she just didn't have an interest or the urge to be a good actor. She's not a good actor. She was also in one of the Conan movies with Arnold Schwarzenegger. Striking looking woman, moves beautifully, and a very elegant body. A really talented dancer, but not a good actor. Which isn't to say she's unintelligent. You can't get to the level of dance that she was in without having brain. And it is unfortunate, because she could have had a great career as an action star had she chosen to take that path and had she really applied herself to the art of acting. But in this one, she's does have a scene where she's supposed to act seductively in order to keep the juices flowing in Sam Hell, and there's a scene around a campfire where she strips to some 1980s underwear and does a sensuous dance, and it is very sensuous. She moves gracefully and athletically and beautifully in that scene, and it's at a different level than the rest of the movie in some ways. And yes, even though it is very prurient and is kind of totally gratuitous, she is a good enough dancer that it makes it interesting at several levels, one of which, of course, is the lust thing. Yes, she's a beautiful woman. But at another level, the beauty of her movements is also a consideration in that. And she does another dance scene, the Dance of the Three Snakes, when she's captured by Toady, the head of Frogtown, and is required to do the Dance of the Three Snakes, not knowing what the three snakes are. I'll leave that for people to find out for themselves. But in that one, the dance, you know, you can see that she's a graceful and beautiful dancer, and that's kind of where she is at in this movie. She's attracted to Sam Hell as well, or her character is attracted to Sam Hell. She rebuffs him because she's supposed to keep his juices going. Then when she genuinely wants to get together with him, he rejects her. And that's one of the other aspects of this movie that's kind of funny. Roddy Piper is reluctant to seduce women in this film, even though he freelanced and spread his seed around before he was captured. He does have a certain shyness and courtesy about the way he goes about things in this film, not to the extent that we have now, but to a large extent, he's a gentlemanly kind of character, given the fact that he's just there primarily as a stud bull. Now, I think that's an interesting approach. It could be played any number of ways, that kind of character in a movie. It could be played as just the horny hound dog and basically played it in that sense straight. But in this movie, they decide to take it in another direction. And Roddy Piper, even though he wasn't, he's not going to play Shakespeare, he wouldn't have played Shakespeare any time. But in this kind of role, he was good. His acting is competent. He's fun to watch on the screen. He puts across the emotions he's supposed to feel realistically. Of course, there is a large acting component to professional wrestling. So he's had some training in that as well. And he is fun in this film. Then we get on to Looney Tunes, played by Rory Calhoun, who's an old friend of Sam's. And it's good to have him in there as well. It would have been pretty much the opposite of a sausage fest had he not been in there. But he's in there and he performs an important function, being their guide around Frogtown. There's also another character who's kind of interesting, and it's a female frog who is working on the side of the medtechs. And her name is Arabella, played by Christy Summers. And she's kind of interested in Sam Hill. She's a bit kinky as far as being a frog's concerned, is attracted to a human being. But in this movie, she's kind of affected by the fact that she's got to wear a mask, a frog mask, and frog gloves with the pads on the fingertips. And kind of looks like a green Martha Ray, in a sense. But, she's there and plays the comedy aspects of things. I think the character's treated a little unkindly in the movie, being a frog, and trying to seduce Sam Hill, and he asks her to put a bag over her head, and they get interrupted during their assignation. It's like I said, it's not politically correct, but I think her character was a little hard done by. And yes, maybe I'm seeing too much into the film by going into the problems of a female double agent frog in this flick, but nonetheless, it is I would have liked more things to happen good for her particular character, though. You've got to remember, this is an 86 minute New World picture, so they can't really cram a lot in there. The whole thing is to get the movie out under 90 minutes, keep it entertaining, get it to make its money back, don't have the budget too high, and go with it there. There is some interesting location stuff as well. They do use an old abandoned steel mill in California as one of the main sets. You may have seen it in any number of post-apocalyptic movies at the time, but it does work well. It's got the kind of large-scale architecture that puts across the post-apocalyptic stuff as well as you can in this kind of movie. There's also the climactic scene, which occurs on Vasquez Rocks, a really well-known location in movies that are shot in California. The arena scene, for instance, in the original Star Trek was filmed there. There were some bits from Amazon Women on the Moon filmed there. Any place that wants to do a nod to previous works of science fiction, any movie is going to play out at Vasquez Rocks. It's got that great big sloping bedding plane of rock there. It's in its own slightly smaller way, it's as iconic a movie location as Monument Valley is in John Ford westerns. And it's good to see them doing there. It is a national park, so it's interesting that they were able to put off large explosions there. But there is a good fight between William Smith's character and Sam Hill up on the rocks, which kind of plays pretty well. Like I said, it's a low budget 89 minute movie, so they didn't have a lot of time for setups and things, but they put across the kind of dangers of being up that high and all that kind of stuff pretty well. And you gotta like the movie for that. For a start, it's a movie that takes that post-apocalyptic thing and takes it in an entirely new direction by adding the frogs, by adding the kind of matriarchal society that emerges after the apocalypse, which is a sore point for one of the villains in particular in this film. But it kind of works well, and in a weird sense, it is kind of like George Miller saw this movie before he made Fury Road and decided to make a more modern and feminist version of Hell Comes to Frogtown, getting rid of the frogs, but having the rescue of a whole bunch of fertile women in the desert while you're driving an unusual vehicle around with a strong female action characters with you, and a protagonist who is in a way not the main character for most of the film. So yeah, I mean, an interesting double feature. I would like somebody to do a double feature of Hell Comes to Frogtown and Fury Road back to back. I think that'd be really a cool thing. I would pay money to go to a cinema that's showing those two movies back to back as a double feature. And if anybody from the Astor in Melbourne is listening, it's a suggestion for you. I may even put it up to Zach Hepburn, who runs the Astor, on Facebook to see whether he's interested in putting those two movies together, because I really think that they're kind of, one's a funhouse mirror version of the other. But again, you come up against that problem you always have with these older films. They're not politically correct. They do some things in them that nowadays can be perceived as slightly creepy, but nonetheless, they are of their time, and they're on that continuum from utterly sexist movies to modern ones that are trying in a lot of cases to be less sexist and to show more of a gender balance. And this one at least makes a few nods in that direction and does keep the, you know, there's not maximum nudity in it. There's only one nude scene by one of the characters. And the female characters are at least characterized in a sense that, even though they are slightly cliched and they've got the thing of Spangle wearing glasses and having her hair pinned up and Hill taking off her glasses and taking her hair down and saying she's beautiful and all that kind of thing, where it is pretty plain to anybody who even looks at her that Sandor Bergman is a beautiful woman, even with the glasses and even with her hair pinned up. It's one of those stupid conceits from movies that this movie perpetuates, and it's one that I never really liked. If you can't see past a pair of glasses and a hairstyle to someone's physical and beauty of character, then you're really not paying enough attention to be worth anyone's serious consideration. It's really a dumb conceit that it goes back to almost to silent pictures, that particular little trope, and it's one that always annoyed me and was never particularly convincing as far as a movie trope is concerned. But again, this is a VHS era movie. Played in drive-ins, it played on VHS. It wasn't meant to be a wonderful piece of cinema. It was meant to be an entertainment and a light entertainment, mostly for young men. And in that, it does succeed. It gets about a 5.8 on IMDb. But nonetheless, it's a bit of fun, and it's a good reminder that Roddy Piper did have some skills as an actor playing comedy stuff. It was done, made in the same year that he did They Live as well. So it was kind of the high point of his cinematic career. But They Live, of course, is a much more serious movie, even though it's got little bits of humour in it. I think these two back-to-back, Hell Comes to Frogtown and They Live, are pretty much the go-to films for the cinematic career of Roddy Piper. And it's sad that he died at the age of 61 of a heart attack. Whether that's steroid related or anything like that, I simply don't know, but it does seem that a number of wrestlers do die prematurely for whatever reason, and it is kind of sad that somebody who's got this cult movie iconic status does step on the rainbow. But anyway, that's about it for that movie. Going to take a break, and when I get back, we're going to 1996 for another film, which is a fairly low budget but interesting science fiction effort, and that is Space Truckers, starring Dennis Hopper, Stephen Dorff, and Debbie Mazar.
Attention, all personnel. The room is sealed.
Set your weapons for close range.
In the year 2196.
Just lost contact with Command Post 3 outside the second perimeter.
It's right outside!
Someone has developed the ultimate destructive force. All they need is a man who'll deliver.
What have you got?
It is a rush shipment to Earth.
No questions asked.
We'll do it.
Geez, I've never seen trailers like these before. They look,
creepy.
better power down, can you?
It's coming! Look
out! You gotta tell us how to stop these things.
Dennis Hopper, Stephen Dorff, and Debbie Mazar.
Fire it up!
Space Truckers.
There's not a real lot that's of value in that trailer, unless you see the visuals. So I'm sorry, but hopefully we'll do better with the verbal stuff. So Space Truckers is a 1996 American-British-Irish comic science fiction film written and directed by Stuart Gordon, starring Dennis Hopper, Stephen Dorff, Debbie Mazar and Charles Dance. It was filmed in Ireland, of all places. Maybe there were some tax breaks or something, but they filmed it at Ardmore Studios in Ireland, which is why you get so many English and Irish actors in it. It's a working-class science fiction film set in space, which is it's not a unique thing, but it's an interesting approach. And in fact, Stuart Gordon's writer in this film, Ted Mann, who used to be the editor of National Lampoon, said this: "It's the first outer space road movie. The film has no scientists, really, no techies, none of the usual polished sanitary environments that we're used to in our space films. Space is like anywhere else. The people who are there are underpaid and poorly regarded." So basically, in a weird sense, it's a working class science fiction comedy, which is a little bit unusual. It was directed by Stuart Gordon, who has had a long career in genre films. He did things like Reanimator, From Beyond, Dolls, Robot Jocks, Castle Freak. Let's see, he did a couple of episodes of Masters of Horror back in 2005-2007. Directed a very interesting smaller film with William H. Macy called Edmund in 2005, which was based on a play by David Mamet. Now, I've got a copy of Edmund, but I haven't had a chance to watch it yet, and I really should, because it's got David Mamet play and William H. Macy, Joe Mantegna. I should do that movie in the future. But anyway, back to Space Truckers. I saw this movie when it first came out on VHS. And in fact, I was on a science fiction convention panel in San Diego in 2008 with one of the producers. Now, I can't remember which one of the producers it was, because that was 18 years ago. I mean, cut me some slack. But we were having a chat about the need for over-the-top special effects and over-the-top visuals, overwhelming the story of whichever piece it is. And he said, well, the audience expects that. The audience expects great big visuals and over-the-top special effects and things in their genre films, and have done ever since Star Wars. And I kind of just looked at him and said, who created that expectation? Now, let's see who the producer was. I'm just looking at the production. There's about 8-10 producers in this film. It might have been Greg Johnson or Guy Collins. Let's see, Stephen Kay, maybe, or Peter Newman. Could have been any one of those. But he was quite a nice guy, and we ended up agreeing about a lot of things about genre science fiction films. But at the time, I had a bugbear about special effects being the most important thing in a science fiction film. I don't think it is. And I think very much Space Truckers, which I liked at the time, and I told him I enjoyed a lot, has that, because it does have the visuals, but it has imaginative visuals. This is pre-CG. This is all physical effects and stuff like that. And it works really well. The cast is kind of interesting too. Of course, you've got Dennis Hopper playing John Canyon, the last independent trucker in the universe. You've got a kind of new up-and-coming guy played by Stephen Dorff, who works for the big company but doesn't really want to, and ends up his name's Mike Pucci. You never hear his name very much in the movie, but he's a kind of up-and-comer who ends up heading off with Canyon. Then you got Debbie Mazar, who's a cult actress I like a lot. She's been in Entourage, but I don't watch Entourage, and she plays Cindy, who is a waitress at a truck stop in the movie. Now, the interesting thing about this is the truck stop itself is fucking terrific. Given the limited budget, this is only a $25 million film, and even at the time, that wasn't a hell of a lot of spondoolings. They do a hell of a lot of stuff with this. They've got to create a cyborg army, which they do, and do quite well. They've got to have zero-G combat around a couple of spaceships, which they do. And then they have the really cool truck stop where Cindy works. And what they're doing there is, it's curved. Remember in 2001 where you got Keir Gillet and Gary Lockwood running in the circle of the big ring that's rotating to give them a fake gravity in the habitat? They actually do that with a truck stop. So basically it's a diner in a ring. And they do it by having, of course, a curve set, and some of the actors up the curves are strapped in secretly and all that kind of thing. But it does look very cool, and it's a diner you really want to go to because it does have that. It's not particularly big, so you'd have problems, I suppose, with a habitat that's more rotating fast enough to give you pseudo gravity up to 1G, because basically every time you turn your head you'd be at risk of a stroke because of the differences in the Coriolis forces between your head and your feet. But nonetheless, given that, the science isn't entirely accurate, but they at least give a nod to the science by not having artificial gravity, which is kind of cool and does present certain problems. For instance, on the truck, which is called a pachyderm in this movie, they've got magnetic shoes that kind of lock into the metal floor surfaces, and all of that kind of stuff. So they've acknowledged the science. They haven't gone the easy thing by just hand waving artificial gravity, and it does give an odd kind of verisimilitude to the world that they create, even though you know it's on a set and there's not a scene that's in, well, there are some scenes in natural environments, but there aren't many scenes in natural environments. You go along for the ride, it's kind of got that slightly Babylon 5-y kind of feel to it. It's a good, honest, working class world they create. And at the start of the film, we see John Canyon hauling square pigs, which are basically a bunch of pigs that are bred on Mars to be cubes. So you've got these squashed in pig faces all up and down the aisles inside the back of the truck. And it's a kind of wry commentary on the way cattle and livestock, well, not cattle, but livestock are treated in the commercial world. So you've got square pigs, which are made squares so they can fit in little slots. And John Canyon does treat them nicely. But it's a nice little effect there of all these kind of puppet pig heads sticking out of the various little apertures in the space container that we have attached to the pachyderm truck. And I kind of like that. It's outrageous and silly, but it's silly in an interesting way, and it shows that these guys actually do know what they're talking about when it comes to science fiction, that they're quite literate in science fiction, which I like. I like people who know the genre, and even when they do fuck around with the tropes of the genre, do it with the knowledge of what they're doing rather than doing it by accident. There's a lot to be said for that kind of approach to things. Then you've got the villain of the piece, who his name at the start of the film was Nabor, but becomes Magnudo, played by Charles Dance, you know, a guy we know from his gravitas and for his skills and things, playing Tywin Lannister in Game of Thrones and all sorts of other things. The main villain in the Last Action Hero. All those kind of things. He's had a long and really interesting career as an actor. In fact, he was in the third, the David Fincher Alien film as well, the one that nobody seems to like. So he's in there and he gets to kind of yuck it up a bit. He's playing a guy who's been pretty fucked up by his first encounter with the killer cyborgs, and he's his body is only half there. He's only got half a head and part of it's been replaced by a computer. His dick works pretty much with a pull handle like a chainsaw, one of those pull lines like a chainsaw, which is a bit funny, particularly when he has an encounter with Cindy, which kind of I like in the sense that it does kind of give us a bit more of Cindy's character. She wants to get back to Earth, and she's pretty much willing to do anything to get back to Earth, including fucking a man who's Dick is basically cybernetic if she has to do it. And I kind of like that. It does give a bit more character to her character, if you know what I mean. And she's definitely there. I mean, of course, her and Stephen Dorff are the love interests with each other, even though she promises to marry John Kenyon if he takes her to Earth. It's not really going to work. He's as rough as guts and really a bit grubby. His clothes are shabby. He's not in a good way, at the best of things. But in spite of that, he's kind of, you know, it's not one of Hopper's best roles, but he's okay in it. Stephen Dorff is okay in it. Debbie Mazar's better. Charles Dance's better in it as well. It's got Shane Rimmer in a villain role. Shane Rimmer, people know from a number of things, including the fact that he was the voice of one of the Thunderbirds in the original television puppet series of the Thunderbirds. And he had that kind of advantage, along with actors like Ed Bishop, in being Americans working in London in the 1960s. So any time there was a movie role that required a genuine American accent, they'd either get Shane Rimmer to do it or they get Ed Bishop to do it. And that's kind of cool too. He's kind of, you know, slightly outside of his normal acting comfort zone. He's not fantastically good in it, but he does get a story arc for his character, who starts out on Triton, the Neptunian moon. The character's name is E.J. Sachs, and he owns the company that creates the cyborgs. And, it's kind of a little bit of a change for Shane Rimmer. I don't know whether they got him because they could get him for the price. There's not many other large-name actors in the film, but it's one of those movies that, yeah, it is of that time of VHS tapes and seeing something in the cinema maybe for a week at a great big multiplex. Not a large scale film, but it's one of those ones that he's not American, Shane Rimmer, he's actually Canadian, so I apologise to Mr. Rimmer, who's still around and hopefully doesn't get affected by the curse of my podcast, where as soon as I talk about an actor for any length of time who's old, he dies. But, he's one of those good, honest, jobbing actors, like a lot of other people. But not too much else to say about Space Truckers. It's a bit of fun. The effects, the physical effects are good. The sets designs are good. The sets are good in themselves. There are some cliched bits and pieces of industrial set when we get into the villain's lair. But the cyborgs that they have are kind of interesting. They're mostly guys with cyborg headgear on, with three big eyes that are also beam projectors. But they kind of work. And once you accept the fact that, yes, this is a killer cyborg, it's part human, part machine, and it's going to knock people off, it's a good choice to make, because most people in those circumstances would suddenly think that what they should be doing is Terminator kind of things. And a lot of people went that way. But Space Truckers doesn't do that. It goes slightly different, and the cyborgs they create are genuinely menacing. I mean, they really fuck people up when they shoot them with those beam weapons. And we do get some nice kind of muckier gore effects. They're not red gore effects, but they're kind of science fiction-y gore effects that when people are hit by these things, you know, limbs, all you have left is a pair of legs with a kind of raw, meaty stump at the end of it. That kind of effect kind of works well. It doesn't go over the top in the gore, because the movie's got a light touch to it. It's a bit of fun. It's a little bit of a non-serious science fiction film. Good, honest B-picture. And as time goes on, I've got a lot of respect for good, honest B-pictures that don't try to be more than they are, but try to be what they are very well. And this is definitely one of those kind of films. It's not one that you're going to watch all the time. It's not going to turn up on anybody's favourite film of all times lists. But it's one that if you saw it at the time it came out, you've got a fondness for it. It's like visiting somebody that you used to work with years before and that you liked. It's got that kind of congeniality that a lot of films just don't have. And I like it for that reason. It's it's fun. And fun is never to be underestimated in science fiction films. And that's one of the advantages, of course, getting back to another subject that's been talked about on the podcast. That, I think, is the big difference between the DC superhero films and the Marvel ones. The Marvel ones have got that balance of the light touch against the dead serious grim stuff. And the DC films are taking things in a much more dark and heavy and almost operatic way, which kind of doesn't necessarily work well in the superhero genre. I think the DC animated films do it a lot better. And they do have a balance between the humour and the serious stuff as well. And it's something that I think while Zack Snyder is doing the DC tentpole kind of films, that maybe it lacks a little bit. But the reason I was doing these two films, apart from the death of Roddy Piper, is that lightness. It's nice to kind of step back a little bit and go, okay, what's fun? Which science fiction movies from whatever time are the ones that are just snack food movies in a sense? You sit down with a beer, you sit down with a bowl of cashews or something, and you just kind of, you know, have an entertainment and a little bit of fun. And I love that kind of movie increasingly as time goes on. I like serious film as well, but there are times when you've got some time to kill, you don't feel like exercising, which for me is most of the time, and you just want to have something that, you know, it's going to fill the time and be a bit of fun. And maybe you saw it previously and you've forgotten all the little bits of detail about it because there have been so many films in between then and now. Now, I average out about 400 films a year. So you've got to consider that if I average out 400 films a year and I saw a movie 10 years ago and haven't seen it since, then there are 4,000 films in between my last viewing of that film and now. And so it's good that I can kind of revisit a film like this and go, oh, yeah, I can remember the Square Pigs. I remember the fact that Debbie Mazar and Stephen Dorff and Dennis Hopper in it. But I forgot that Charles Dance was in it, and I forgot how cool the monsters were, and I forgot that really groovy diner that's in a spinning ring of a space habitat. And so there are all these things that come flooding back to you as you watch the film, which you can appreciate fresh. And that's what I got from watching both Hell Comes to Frogtown and Space Truckers. The bits I've forgotten and that I can see fresh and go, okay, yeah, that worked. That didn't work. And Roddy Piper was okay in this bit and surprisingly good in this bit, but a little bit ropey in this bit. And yes, even though I do like Sandor Bergman, she's not a good actor. All of those kind of things that you have in your mind while you're watching a movie can come fresh when you revisit one after a decade or two of not seeing the film. And maybe it's worth doing that now and then. There are new things. There are things that you never knew about. For instance, Notorious, I'd never seen before. But, there are these kind of B pictures, which are kind of cool. And not to be totally disrespected, I think, in genre. But that's about it for this time around. I do have a new Patreon subscriber. And it's kind of cool that I do. And Steve Sullivan is on board with the Patreon campaign, which I love the fact that he is. And Steve, if there's any of your projects you want to promote on the podcast, drop me a line. And I'll remember to mention them in the next podcast. I'm happy to do that for you as a Patreon subscriber. You also get to pick one of the movies that I do for the podcast. I've got a list and I'm working my way through the list as the podcast goes on. But I'm more than happy for Patreon. Oh, and I've just checked the emails and I've got another Patreon subscriber, Kathleen. So I'm going to have to message Kathleen and find out what she wants to be in the credits as well. So really happy to do that. Thank you, thank you, thank you. A lot of these people I know from Facebook, but there are people that come in that I don't know that listen to the podcast, and they are equally welcome. I am a river to my people, as Anthony Quinn said in Lawrence of Arabia. And I'm always happy to do what I need to do to show my gratitude to people who are willing to be part of the Patreon campaign and people who aren't, people who listen loyally. I'm not trying to make two classes of listener in this podcast, but there are, of course, extra things you get for subscribing via the Patreon campaign at patreon.com/paleocinema. But I would never consider the people who don't do it or can't do it or don't have the wherewithal to do it or choose not to do it are in any way lesser listeners. But what, given the nature of this kind of support, there are extra things that people do get for that. Steve Sullivan is and does have a title now, and his title is Director of Monster Effects, which is kind of cool. And I will get in touch with Kathleen and find out which credit Kathleen wants and whether she wants to suggest movies for the podcast. More than happy to do that. Anyway, on that cheerful note and on that happy note and on that very gratifying note, I'm going to play the credits apart from the two that I've mentioned. And in the meantime, enjoy yourselves. Keep watching the skies. Watch good films. Watch bad films. Watch films with people you love. Watch them by yourself. I don't care. Just watch movies. And I'll be back in a week with a Paleo Cinema, 2 weeks with a Martian Drive-In podcast. Take care of yourselves, okay? Bye. And here are the credits for the Patreon subscribers to the podcast in the style of movie credits. I'd like to thank Tom the Focus Puller, Sarah the Special Effects Technician, Ian the Caterer, Grant the Technicolor Consultant, Claire the Script Doctor, Gary the Prop Master, Morris the Musical Director, Jan the Dialect Coach, Armin the Key Grip, Matt the Rattlesnake Wrangler, Elaine our Scientific Advisor, Julia our Casting Director, Chris our Camera Operator, Christopher our Gaffer, Miss Jane our Wardrobe Mistress, Tansy the Foley Artist, Alyssa our Location Scout, Mark, our second unit director, Paul, our special makeup effects director, Tammy, the donut wrangler, Tim, the New York unit director, and Rabbi Steve, our spiritual advisor. So thank you to everybody who supports the podcast and to the people who listen to it. If you want to support the podcast with some micropayments, please go to patreon.com/paleocinema, and I'll catch all of you next time.